From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, fighting the opioid addiction in Massachusetts. Despite the progress, a grim milestone. 6 opioid-related deaths every day in the Bay State last year.
The fact is a sobering reminder that we still have a lot more work to do to bend the trend of opioid death.
Also today, in the wake of racial slurs at Fenway Park, why fewer and fewer African Americans are playing and watching professional baseball.
As a black person living in Boston, we didn't always cheer for the Sox. We weren't necessarily against the Sox, but I did not grow up with the culture that the Sox were our team.
Plus, taxing online sales in Massachusetts, and the art of a Boston pitmaster, and the sumptuous joy of cooking meat over fire.
I mean, I think it's built into our DNA.
You know, from our ancestors who ate some meat that was hit by lightning is kind of the start of it.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today with the opioid addiction crisis in Massachusetts. This week, we learned of a grim milestone. According to the Department of Public Health, the number of deaths caused by opioid overdoses last year is expected to top 2,000 for the first time. That means that each day, an average of nearly 6 people inject, smoke, or snort a drug and never wake up. Here's Mary Lou Sutters, the State Secretary of Human Services.
The fact that the absolute number would appear to be just over 2,000 in 2016 is a sobering reminder that we still have a lot more work to do to bend the trend of opioid death.
We learned of those numbers as President Trump named 5 members to a White House commission to combat the opioid crisis, including Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker and former Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy. And joining us now to talk about what remains a vexing health crisis in Massachusetts and across the country is WBUR health reporter Martha Biebinger. And Martha, thanks for coming in.
Sure, Anthony.
So let's start with these numbers and put the headline figure into perspective. A projected 2,069 people who died from opioid-related overdoses in 2016. That sounds like a big number.
It is a big number. It's the first time that the number of deaths in 1 year has crossed 2,000. There are some signs of hope, though, Anthony. That 2,069 people is a 16% increase over 2015. But the rate of increase is actually slowing. So total number rising, but it's not rising quite as fast. And some people see hope in that.
I see. So, but it's still increasing, but the curve of this increase is bending. But what's driving this increase? How much of it is tied to fentanyl versus other drugs?
Right. So this is a controversial area, but some people think that the curve would actually be bending a lot faster if we weren't dealing with so much fentanyl. 78% of the deaths included fentanyl. And fentanyl is a very fast-acting opioid. It can kill people within seconds. So there's very little time from the point at which you see someone go out to the point at which they get care. Often they'll need it in a hospital to completely revive them because fentanyl is hard to reverse with that naloxone drug that all of the EMTs carry now. So if we weren't seeing as much fentanyl, perhaps we wouldn't see as many deaths. The rates of heroin use are down. Benzodiazepines, drugs that people mix, which can increase the chances of an overdose, are down. But fentanyl, that really strong opioid, is killing a lot of people.
So what do we know about how these numbers here in Massachusetts compare to what's happening nationally?
We don't have real-time or pretty close to real-time data nationally. The Baker administration is doing a laudable job of getting out data very quickly these days. So what we can compare nationally goes back to 2015. And there, if you look at what's reported to the Centers for Disease Control, Massachusetts was not in the top 5 states. It may be now. It's hard to tell exactly what's happening. But Rhode Island, New Hampshire, states around us have always had traditionally high rates, along with West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, some other states in the Rust Belt.
So you mentioned efforts here under Governor Charlie Baker. The president, President Trump, has named five members of this commission aimed at tackling the opioid epidemic, including Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. What specifically is the goal of this commission? What's its purpose?
Well, they're going to meet and issue a report with recommendations about how to address the opioid epidemic. And a lot of people are frustrated by that because they say we don't need more meetings. We have the former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who was just pushed out by the Trump administration, who had issued a sweeping report earlier this year. There's lots known about what needs to be done. And this commission is going to start meeting soon, hopefully, expected to issue a report by next year. But there's no now, you know, in their mission. There's talk and listen.
I see. All right. And what do you make of the fact that Governor Baker, as well as a couple of other people with Massachusetts ties, are on this panel? Is that a reflection of how well Massachusetts is responding to this crisis, or what do you make of that?
I don't know if it's a reflection of the response, but it's definitely a reflection of the activity here. So Governor Baker was very instrumental in passing legislation last year that launched a seven-day limit on prescriptions, first-time opioid prescriptions. That was new and different. The Massachusetts Medical Society has endorsed the idea of supervised injection sites. That's something that's unique among medical societies around the country. We're a wealth of research on addiction, so Dr. Bertha Madras is part of that community and certainly makes sense for somebody to be in that space. Representative Kennedy, former congressman from Rhode Island, another state with very high opioid addiction rates. So we are seeing a lot of representatives from states that are dealing with this on a daily basis.
And Martha, in terms of what more needs to be done, I want to hear one more time from Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters about her take on what needs to happen. Let's just listen for a moment.
We need to think bolder and with different strategies. And there's a lot of discussion around safe injection sites, looking at having Narcan in sort of emergency boxes in places like Cambridge. And we are open to all of these ideas.
So talk a little bit about what she's talking about. First of all, safe injection sites and looking to have Narcan in emergency boxes in places like Cambridge, right?
Right. So Secretary Sutter says the face of the epidemic is changing and we need to consider some things that may have been unthinkable a few years ago. Supervised injection site is not something that you would expect to hear a Republican administration say, sure, let's see the science. Let's look at the proof. Tell me if this is going to work. The problem is, of course, that some of these things are illegal and it will be tricky to carve a space forward that addresses law enforcement and public health concerns.
Interesting. Martha, obviously, this is a huge and vexing crisis that's been with us for a long time and looks like it will continue to be with us for a long time to come. This may be a huge and open-ended question, but you've been looking at this for so long. Why? Why does it continue to challenge us the way it does? What's your view on that?
There are lots of strains there, Anthony. There's the biology of addiction, which we still don't completely understand. What percent of the population gets addicted to what kinds of substances and why that happens? There's a lot of interesting research happening there. Then you go all the way from there to on the ground where we see the Chinese and Mexican the Mexican cartels through the Chinese developing new forms of fentanyl that are becoming more and more deadly. So you're seeing this terrible confluence of people struggling with addiction and drugs that really almost no one can survive.
Well, it's a difficult story. WBUR's health reporter Martha Bieminger does a great job covering it. Thank you for coming in and talking to us
today.
Thank
you, Anthony.
All right, attention internet shoppers. There are new rules going into effect here in Massachusetts. Starting July 1st, out-of-state online retailers will be required to start collecting sales taxes. Governor Charlie Baker's administration estimates this could bring in roughly $30 million for the next fiscal year. But that extra cash could come with a legal fight. WBUR's Asma Khalid is with our tech and innovation team, Bostonomics, and she's been looking into the new sales tax and the questions that surround it, and she's with us now. Asma, good to have you.
Hey, happy to be here.
So to begin, I want you to help me understand how big a market is this?
Well, Anthony, you know, the state, I think, is always looking for a bit of extra money. No state would ever say no to this. And, you know, here in Massachusetts, I think we've all heard the stories of how tax revenue this April was down. Sales tax in general has kind of been slumping. And the basic premise is not really unique specifically to Massachusetts. I spoke with someone at the National Conference of State Legislatures. They estimated that in 2015, states across the country lost roughly $17 billion in uncollected taxes.
That's real money.
From electronic sales. And so year after year, e-commerce sales have been growing. They estimate by about 15% a year. So it's a growing market, and it's how many of us shop. I put out a general social media call out, and I heard from Michelle O'Brien. She's 44 and lives in Chelsea, and this is what she had to say about her shopping habits.
I buy most of my laundry detergent, shampoos, and stuff like that online. Sometimes electronics online. Almost everything, really, besides groceries.
But Asma, I mean, I presume that a lot of this online shopping happens on Amazon. And if you buy something on Amazon, it's already taxed, right?
That's right, Anthony. So Amazon, folks might remember, acquired a robotics company here in Massachusetts, Kiva, a few years ago. It also has warehouses in the state. So that means that Amazon has a physical presence here in Massachusetts. And the reason that Amazon then has to collect taxes all dates back to this 1992 Supreme Court decision that said a company has to have a substantial in-state physical presence in order, you know, to sort of be required to collect taxes. A lot of businesses, though, and a lot of companies will say that that's just an outdated way of thinking in the era of smartphone shopping. I specifically heard some concerns about this from Bill Rennie. He's with the Retailers Association of Massachusetts.
For years, our members have argued that it's an unlevel playing field. And if a sale is made, you know, the state has a sales tax, we should apply that fairly.
And Anthony, right now, if you went online, say to like Overstock.com, you could do that right now and look for, I don't know, like a hammock, some bed sheets, whatever you want. It'll look like it's all tax-free. And the thing is, we're supposed to pay taxes when we file our annual tax returns. But in reality, nobody really does that, right? Nobody's sitting there calculating all the independent sales tax they're supposed to pay from online shopping. And so a lot of states have begun to realize that they are leaving tax revenue on the table. And they're really, you know, it's something that they need to do about it.
All right. So what's Massachusetts specifically doing about it?
So the Department of Revenue has issued a directive for out-of-state online retailers. This specifically means if you're a company that had 100 or more sales within Massachusetts that totaled at least $500,000 last year, you're going to have to start collecting sales tax from online shoppers. Massachusetts, you know, some folks have told me, is kind of adopting an overly literal definition of that 1992 Supreme Court ruling to justify this. They're saying that cookies stored locally on your computer. These are cookies, are sort of text files, right? Stored on your browser or a shopping app. Say you have a Blue Fly or something that you download that app to your phone. That then creates a physical in-state operation.
Oh, come
company.
On. That seems like a stretch, doesn't it? Just a little bit.
You know, to some, Anthony, this might seem like sheer genius, right?
Yeah, okay.
To others, it is a shameless tax grab. I talked to Richard Jones about this. He's a tax attorney with the firm Sullivan & Worcester here in Boston, and he told me he is troubled by the Massachusetts logic.
If you take this Department of Revenue directive at its face value, it's saying that internet cookies and bits of software or apps or tangible personal property, what that would really mean is that every owner of every website in the entire world would all be deemed to have personal property and therefore physical presence in Massachusetts. And that would turn the concepts of state tax jurisdiction and nexus completely on its head.
So Anthony, he's saying really not only is this unprecedented, right, but it's also just completely counterintuitive to the way that people currently think of state tax law. That means literally every company with a website would technically be able to collect in every other state. And he told me that if you go back and you look specifically at that 1992 Supreme Court ruling, there was an issue around a handful of floppy disks. And the Supreme Court did say that back in the day, in the era of mail order catalogs and floppy disks, a handful of floppy disks was not enough to set a tax threshold.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it raises the question. I mean, are declaring cookies a sort of physical presence? I mean, is this legal?
Anthony, I would say that is the question I've been hearing from everyone. Stephen Del Bianco is with this group called NetChoice. It's a national trade association that represents e-commerce and online businesses. He thinks that this is all ridiculous. He thinks it doesn't really hold any water. It does not not hold up to common sense. And for him, really, there's only one way to fight it at this point, to fight the idea, right, that a cookie stored locally on your computer is the same thing as, say, a storefront on Newberry Street. And he told me the only way to do this is through a legal challenge.
We're researching the legal arguments and raising the funds to pursue a lawsuit right now. Too soon to say when we'll be ready.
And so, Anthony, I don't think this is entirely empty threats, right? Other states have tried to implement similar rules, not necessarily using this cookie justification that Massachusetts is, doing it a little bit more sort of outright and direct, and they have faced legal challenges. And so Stephen says that, you know, they are looking at a legal fight here in Massachusetts.
So Asma, what does that mean for now then, or going forward in the near future?
So, Anthony, for now, the directive does take effect July 1. So if you are a big online shopper, you may notice just a couple of extra dollars probably when you check out at certain websites. I asked Richard Jones, the tax attorney, about this, and he told me, though, that he does not think the state actually really has a solid case moving forward, that essentially if this was to go to any lawsuit, he actually thinks a taxpayer or someone fighting this would have a better case. And he said that's in part for a whole bunch of reasons. But basically, he says it's really hard to prove that internet cookies are going to be tangible property.
One would think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then he said the other thing that's tough is, like, assuming that these cookies are, you know, you make the argument that they're physical property. Well, then who owns them? Does the customer own them? It's your computer, right, Anthony? Or is it the actual retailer? And I asked Richard, you know, the real big question of what he actually thinks about the overall idea of online sales tax. Is this an outdated way of thinking, right, when so many people are shopping online? And he kind of hedged. He really didn't want to answer that question directly. But he told me that for a long time, the reason that retailers had to prove this, you know, had to prove that they had an in-state operation is that it's really complicated, our tax system. So if you're a relatively small business and you've got to collect and file taxes in many different states with all different types of rules, that's a sort of unfair burden for a lot of small companies. So, you know, we'll have to see where things go from here. But one sort of final thing I want to mention, Anthony, is that this is not a topic that is exclusively limited to Massachusetts. It has come up time and time again when it comes to sort of congressional legislation in the U.S. Congress, and there is another piece of legislation up this year. Both Massachusetts Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey have co-signed the bill, but we'll see if that gets anywhere.
Well, really interesting times and all kinds of interesting questions. That's WBUR's Bostonomics reporter Asma Khalid, and you can find a link to her reporting at our website, radioboston.org. Asma, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, the complicated history behind race and baseball in Boston. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to talk now about baseball and race, which have a complicated history, particularly here in Boston. We were reminded of that 10 days ago when a spectator or spectators at Fenway Park threw a bag of peanuts and hurled racial slurs at Adam Jones of the Baltimore Orioles. Now, as we know, the Red Sox, Mayor Marty Walsh, Governor Charlie Baker all condemned this racist assault. The Red Sox apologized to Jones and to the Orioles and said the franchise was sickened by the conduct of the ignorant few. And then they banned a fan who used a racial slur the next evening from Fenway Park for life, the first time ever that that's happened. So the good news is that everyone in charge made it clear that this kind of racist behavior is unacceptable at Fenway or anywhere else for that matter. And of course, the days of segregated baseball leagues are a distant memory. But consider this. The number of African-American baseball players in the major leagues peaked in 1970s and has been going down ever since. Right now, out of 750 active major league players, just 63 are African Americans. So that's what we want to talk about. What's going on here? Why so few? And how does the recent episode at Fenway Park possibly relate to this? We'd love to hear from you on this. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about why so few African Americans play baseball And if you go to Fenway Park, why so few African Americans are in the stands looking at baseball games? And joining us to talk about all this is Adrian Burgos. He's a professor of African American and Latin American history and a baseball historian at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And Adrian Burgos, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us is Shira Springer. She's WBUR's sports and society reporter. And Shira, always good to see you.
Likewise. Good to see you, Anthony.
So, Adrian, let me start with you and just that sort of interesting number. The number of African-American baseball players in the major league has been going down since its peak in the 1970s. What explains this?
One of the critiques that myself and other baseball historians have really talked about is part of the decline of the interest of African-Americans in playing baseball has to do with both how the manner that Major League Baseball pursued integration effectively caused the disintegration of the black baseball infrastructure.
Hmm.
You know, there were the Negro Leagues, there were leagues that supported the Negro Leagues, and there was a talent pipeline. And Major League Baseball teams, for example, when it came to signing someone like Willie Mays, they would pay the owner of the Birmingham Black Barons for a talent such as Willie Mays $10,000 or $15,000. When if Willie Mays had been white, it would have been $200,000 or so that they would have paid. But
so what did that provide? A sort of that provided a disincentive for African Americans to sort of stay connected to the game.
Right, and particularly it was after their playing careers. And so Bob Gibson was going to be a major league player. He was going to pitch and actually started playing with the Harlem Globetrotters first in basketball. But they were already in the pipeline. It was the next generation. Did a player like Jackie Robinson have a place to manage after his playing career? Did Frank Robinson have a place to manage? Well, in fact, Frank Robinson's first managerial gig was in Puerto Rico in the Puerto Rican Winter League. And then the Cleveland Indians came across and said, we'll hire you. And it's the entirety of a career in black baseball or in baseball that changed with integration, ironically, because there were the Buck O'Neills and the John Donaldson and the Alex Bombez who wanted to, and were off-the-field figures in bringing in African-American talent and black Latino talent into baseball, but they were few and far between.
Interesting, Adrian. Shira, you're nodding your head. I'd love to bring you in on this.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the whole issue of a pipeline and taking it, you know, from history down to the modern day, which is where are these, you know, African-American players going to come from today? You know, I think that Adrian's talking about role models and not having them in coaching and general manager positions, but I also think you have to look from the bottom up as mm-hmm. well, and you have to look at Little League and youth leagues and what's being done to bring in young African-Americans into the sport. I think it's very interesting that every single Major League Baseball team has a development academy in the Dominican Republic, and that's where a lot of young talent is coming from. And I don't think that system is as robust in American cities where you could recruit some of these young African-American players. I also think we have to look at what's happening at that age, you know, it's at 12, 13, 14, 15, when you have people saying that the players who could go on, the young black players who could go on to the major leagues are being pulled into football and basketball. And I think another critical part of this equation, when we're talking about a pipeline and bringing those numbers, that percentage up, I think the percentage today is around 8%. If we want to bring that percentage up, we have to also look at what is the U.S. development system, and that's the college ranks. And there are much fewer college scholarships for baseball players. So African-American players who are in the major leagues today said if they had to make a choice, if they weren't a first-round draft pick, if they had to make a choice between playing baseball in college and maybe getting a partial scholarship or playing basketball or football and getting a full scholarship, of which there are many more, they would have chosen football or basketball.
Interesting. Adrian, let me come to you and ask you about the fans, because that's sort of where this conversation started. You know, the Red Sox are integrated on the field, certainly, but if you look at a stadium like Fenway Park, it's still a very white fan base. And to what extent is that the story across the country, and why? I mean, is this all related to what we've been talking about because the pipeline for black players is so limited?
I think you see across the country that you have areas where you see many more fans of color. The Los Angeles Dodgers, for one, they did a survey of their fans just last year, and that is they sent people into the stands from employees to see who's there, and there are over 50% Latinos who are in the stands at Dodger games at Chavez Ravine. On the other hand, What's fascinating is Fenway Park is such a draw. It's also a very pretty penny to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And Fenway itself, the fans there are not fully representative of the Boston metro area.
Yeah.
You see, there are many more African Americans and Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and Haitian Americans around the Boston metro area. And they're fans of the Red Sox. They just don't get to Fenway.
Interesting.
And part of that has a longer history of, do they feel welcome?
Sure.
Do they feel it's worth the investment of $200, $300, $400, $500 for a night out? Or are they going to feel, you know, it's easier to stay home and watch it there. It's safer.
No, that's a good point. And Shira, I want to ask you about this because you and I have both seen this over the years. There have been times when the fan base at Fenway suddenly does feel more diverse. And I'm thinking back when Pedro Martinez was dominating the pitcher's mound and there were Dominican flags out there. And suddenly you look around and say, this is a different
crowd.
A different color of Boston, right?
Yeah, no, I remember when Pedro would pitch and Adrian was talking about, do they feel it's worth the investment? Well, I can say for sure that, you know, people from the Dominican Republic who are living in Boston certainly felt it was worth the investment to pay for a ticket to Fenway to see Pedro pitch. And the ballpark was completely different. The whole atmosphere.
Yeah, it really was.
More festive. I mean, it was like you were actually watching a game in the Dominican Republic when Pedro pitched. It was amazing. And, you know, I wish the Red Sox could figure out a way to make that connection to some of the players that they have on the team now, whether they're African-American players or Latino players. I think there is some disconnect because I haven't seen that recently.
Adrian,
please jump back in. In particular, because the World Baseball Classic was a powerful showcase of when we have different kinds of fandom express themselves at the ballpark, it sets for a different feeling. And one of the things, and this is not exclusive to Fenway, this is really around Major League Baseball, is that in Major League Baseball, the fans, the spectatorship is very different than in the Dominican Republic. I remember the game in Miami, the Dominican Republic's playing against the U.S. One of the U.S. relief pitchers comes in, and he said, after postgame, I was shaking on the mound. They were so loud. But you know what they weren't doing? They weren't cursing the pitcher out. They weren't throwing racial epithets. They were celebrating their team. They were singing songs. And there's a particular way of fandom. You see all in Japan, where you have the whole crowds singing the song for the Japanese team while they're batting throughout the game. It's a different culture.
That's great.
And so one of the fascinating dimensions is how much has the culture of spectatorship changed in Major League Baseball from the time of Jackie Robinson to today?
I think a lot of that has to do with the cost of the ticket.
Interesting. Folks, I want to bring some callers into this conversation. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the participation of African Americans in the great game of baseball. Why so few? And perhaps why so few are watching? That's certainly the case here if you've been to Fenway Park lately. Let's go to Tony, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Tony, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hey, guys. So first of all, I'm really actually very disappointed in what the Red Sox did in response to the Anthony Jones situation. You know, the Red Sox, the mayor, the governor, they all issued a statement. Hey, good for them. They issued a statement. But I don't think they really took strong action. And to me, strong action would have been the next day before the game, they would have brought perhaps Dustin Pedroia, Mookie Betts, Hanley Ramirez, so they had a nice diverse group of players to home plate, give them the microphone, and have them talk to the crowd for a few minutes and say, when you issue a racial slur against a player from another team, you are issuing a slur against all of the Red Sox. You are issuing a slur against the Dominican players, the black players, and the white players on both teams. You're issuing a slur to every single person in Boston, and we will not tolerate that. We don't want you here. We don't put up with that. To me, that would have been a strong statement, and that has not been done. You can't just issue a press release and have management say something.
Tony, I got it, and I want to chew over what you're saying with Shira and with Adrian. Adrian, I'd love to get your response to that. I mean, I actually thought that the Red Sox were pretty swift in their response to this incident and made it pretty clear that they would not countenance this kind of behavior. But respond to what Tony is saying. He's saying they should have gone even farther.
Well, I like his suggestion in terms of bringing the diversity of the Red Sox and their lead players. You know, one of the things to me that fell kind of behind, but it was actually a consistent storyline of what was going on here, was Dustin Pedroia and Manny Machado. And that is, you had not only Adam Jones drama happening, but you have Manny being thrown at and Manny keep hitting home runs and running ever more slowly around the bases. Well, I should say walking around the bases. And that's also part of the backdrop of what's going on. There's been this long underlying thread in baseball, in MLB, about how do you play the game the right way. And many instances, it's not just about what goes on in the field, but it's about how spectators and fans and the press receive the action and perceive it. And so having Dustin, who had been the subject of much of the drama, not a fault of his own, and then you having Hanley, having Mookie come out and saying, look, we are Boston strong, and that was Boston wrong the other night. Let's get our culture of baseball and spectatorship.
We are Boston strong. That was Boston wrong. Boy, I wish someone had thought of that, Adrian.
I mean, I guess I see a T-shirt coming out soon.
I see a T-shirt coming out.
Well, and so true confession here. I'm a Yankee fan, and one of the things
we love you just the same, Adrian.
One of the things
to this day remember, and this is to me what fandom can do and can totally change the environment of a field. 1986 World Series. When you have all the fans saying Daryl, there's no need to throw a net racial epithet in there. That shook him. Mm-hmm. That's how you do it. You don't need the N-word. Be 21st century about this. You don't need to be 20th century about it.
Shira, I'd love to sort of get your response. You covered that story, of course, 10 days ago. What do you think about the way the Red Sox responded to it?
Well, I was going
to
say, I think the idea of having players address it on the field is interesting before the game, but I thought it was a very effective moment when Adam Jones came to bat the next night and all of Fenway got on its feet, or most of Fenway got on its feet, and applauded him. And it was sort of their way of apologizing, the fans' way of apologizing. And I like the fact that it came from the fans and that they recognized, you know, the error of that fan who had taunted Adam Jones and were trying to correct it in their own way. I do, however, think that Tony the caller is right and that it would be nice to see some of the players speak out more. I know Mookie Betts before that game issued a tweet, you know, exhorting fans to get on their feet, and combat racism. So I think some, you know, the players model the behavior, or at least they can speak to the type of behavior they want in the ballpark. And let's not forget the next night with the racist incident, they did ban that fan for life from Fenway Park.
Yeah. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Hyde Park. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, I got 2 points to make. First, on the matriculation of African Americans into the league, I think little league sports, high school sports, have become real expensive. I'm a parent of three. I had my kids in hockey for a while. They weren't interested in it. I pulled them out. The cost associated with little leagues, traveling teams, as kids progress, is significant. And maybe people in the African-American community or lower socioeconomic scale can't afford that. Another thing about the fan base, I think the fan base that's in the seats at Fenway Park don't represent the majority of the fan base. I think to get a ticket to any major league sporting event or a concert these days, the prices are astronomical. I have three children. It would be next to impossible for me to get my kids into the park, get them a soda, some drinks, a pennant for less than, you know, $300-$400. And I think that's on a cheap day.
I think you're right, Joe. I mean, I think the cost is truly prohibitive. It's unbelievable what tickets cost for a family of four, three or four or whatever. I mean,
just parking alone can be $45-$50 for Fenway.
Yeah, I think that's but Adrian, speak to Joe's point about just the cost of getting young kids into baseball. I mean, when you talk about baseball, you're talking about large fields, you're talking about equipment, you're talking about teams of, you know, 15 or 20 kids. I mean, it takes a good deal of resources to put something like that together.
And Joe's correct. And I think one of the things that most people don't see is the hidden costs or the subsidization of football at the high school level and in different ways, basketball through AAU and other organizing groups. That is, who pays for the football equipment? There is no football or there's no travel baseball equivalent in football. It is really high school football that is the talent pipeline to college and to the NFL. And who's paying for the football equipment, the football uniforms? Once, yes, there are now fees, particularly at public high schools, that you might pay an activity fee of $100, $200 for your student to be an athlete on that team to participate. But it's a lot more expensive. We just don't see it in football, but in baseball, it is entirely on the parents. And moreover, the talent pipeline in amateur baseball is not the high school, it's the travel team. And that's where the expense really comes in.
Yeah, really, really interesting. Let's take a couple more calls. Stanley is calling from Worcester. Stanley, good to have you on the air. What's your point today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The recent fracas at Fenway Park resurrected an experience that I had two times. Being a little kid from Lower Roxbury, we were taken by a counselor from the Robert Louis Shaw House in Lower Roxbury. We were taken, 15 of us were taken to Fenway Park to see the baseball game. We're the only dark-skinned, nappy-head people in the place. People threw food down on us, bottles and everything. The counselor was so upset. He confronted one of the people. He got into a fist fight with one of them. The policeman was standing up there, and he saw what was going on. He didn't do anything. I was never so terrified in my life. I think the counselor of that settlement house, I guess he was trying to prove something about civil rights. He took us back there another time, the same experience we encountered.
So, Stanley, when did this happen? You said this happened when you were six.
I was 6 years old.
You were 6 years old.
That was back in 1946.
1946, yeah. Have you been back
No, I have no interest.
So that sort of pretty much colored your experience for your life.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I have no interest in baseball. I don't care about Fenway Park. And I see these incidents reoccurring, and it's just so startling to hear.
Well, Stanley, I'm really grateful that you shared this story, and I'm sorry that you experienced something like that. But Shira, talk to Stanley, because, I mean, I want to be sensitive to what he brought up, but I also want to suggest that Fenway Park in 2017 may be a different kind of experience than he experienced back in 1946?
Yeah, I mean, you would hope it is. I think, unfortunately, this organization has a very poor history when it comes to race relations. We all know about Tom Yawkey and his racism. We all know that Pumpsy Green was, the last,
the last team to integrate
with Pumpsy Green. So we know that history. And there is new ownership, and that new ownership has tried to make efforts to diversify both the fan base and I think the players you see on the field. But unfortunately, it's really hard to get past such a deeply entrenched history. That being said, I've gone to probably hundreds of games at Fenway Park. I've never observed anything like what the caller experienced, but I do think it's a changed place. It certainly seems over the years has become more kid-friendly.
Yep.
And I think they're trying, but obviously these recent incidents with Adam Jones and surrounding that, lots of work to be done in Boston and elsewhere. I mean, I don't think this is an isolated problem.
Adrian, you said something early in the segment that I wanted to come back and sort of follow up with you on. And you mentioned that the Los Angeles Dodgers have a much more diverse fan base than we see here in Boston. Why? What are the Dodgers doing differently than what the Red Sox are doing?
Well, again, this is really fascinating because, as Shira just mentioned, the ownership group of the Red Sox have actively sought to get stars. And as an outside observer, Boston won their pennants when they got Manny, Pedro, and Big Papi. As much as we know about Pedroia and Millar and all these other players, without Pedro, there are no pennants up there. Yeah. Without Manny setting a tone, so that is what transformed the Red Sox into a different culture. And look at the team today. You got Xander Bogaerts, you got Mookie, you got Jackie Bradley Jr., you have Eduardo Rodriguez, Christian Vasquez. You have a very diverse team, but that hasn't diversified who's in the stands. So that's one level of it. I think what happens in L.A. is that the Dodgers fans, the Mexican-American and the Japanese-American Dodger fans, feel like they can go to L.A. Dodger Stadium and feel welcome. Their culture is represented there. And they feel, hey, this is our team. And so that is part of what the challenge of the Red Sox management is how do they do that? Plus, the Red Sox is an expensive ticket to get into Fenway. And really, what can you do about that in particular? Because that just changes things.
Absolutely. Well, Adrian Burgos, he's a professor of African American and Latin American history and a baseball historian at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Adrian, great pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us today.
great having the conversation.
And Shira Springer is WBUR's sports and society reporter. Shira, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, Shira is going to be moderating a panel discussion at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study next Tuesday, May 16th, to mark the 45th anniversary of Title IX. You can find information about that at radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, The Art of Barbecue with Andy Husbands and Chris Hart. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Well, the weather is getting warmer in theory, which means it's time to fire up those backyard grills. And some of you may be inspired to step up your grilling game once you hear from Andy Husbands and Chris Hart, because they are true grilling experts. They love cooking meat with fire. Chris and Andy are high school buddies who opened the restaurant Tremont 647 together in the South End more than 20 years ago. Since then, they've gone deep into smoky, juicy barbecue. Now Andy Husbands and Chris Hart have a new book called Pitmaster: Recipes, Techniques, and Barbecue Wisdom. We talked with them about the book and about the joys of smoked meat this morning at Andy Husband's newest restaurant, The Smoke Shop, in Kendall Square. So here's Chris Hart.
Over the years, we've been inspired by various barbecue regions, so we kind of dug into those regions and met pitmasters and learned about not just how do they cook the food, but how did they end up dedicating essentially their lives to cooking meat with fire.
And what attracts you both to that? Andy, I'll start with you. Cooking meat with fire, such a nice idea.
I mean, I think it's built into our DNA from our ancestors who ate some meat that was hit by lightning is kind of the start of it. So, well, it's risky, and you never know. It's like a concert. You never know if is it going to be perfect or exact. It's always changing, and just it's pretty exciting to me.
So when you say it's risky, it's interesting, because when I think about a restaurant, and we're in the smoke shop right now, you've got to do things more or less the same every day because the customers sort of expect it, right?
Yes, consistency is important.
So that's got to be tricky when you talk about cooking with risky fire.
It is. And it's quite challenging. Unlike, sous vide, which we can dial in our temperature and hold our meat to exactly as it needs to be and then pick it up, we really have to pay attention to what we're doing, and it kind of ebbs and flows and constantly checking to make sure it's perfect as it needs to be.
Chris, what about your journey? Yeah, what attracts you to cooking meat with fire?
I think it's a lot of times you end up in the same place, a perfectly cooked brisket, but the way that you get there can be different every single time. And while the recipes in this book, and really any barbecue recipe, tends to be a little bit more of a guideline, and really what being a pitmaster about is, and what's great about cooking meat with fire, is trusting your senses and developing your senses. You know, how does the smoke smell? How does the bark appear? What is the sound of the crispy skin on a whole hog? You can develop those senses, and it's the kind of thing that you only get from years and years of repetition. That's what kind of a pit master is. That doesn't mean you can't get started with just a few hours of experience under your belt as well, though.
Is this book for the novice, relatively inexperienced backyard barbecue person? Is that the idea?
We have this recipe called the 3-2-1 ribs, which Chris helped develop, and anybody can follow this recipe, and anybody will make some of the best ribs they'll ever have the first time out. But what the cool part about that is, the second time out and the third time out, it will be better and better. Like anything, I know sometimes today people want to just make it and it's fantastic, but a lot of things take practice. You could tell me how to do your job, but I don't think I can do your job tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how to do my job. So 3-2-1 ribs. What's the sort of key thing to understand about making delicious ribs, Chris?
The key with all barbecue really is controlling your fire. You don't want to have a grill or a smoker where the temperature is up and down and up and down. You have a nice, consistent, clean fire. You're looking for some thin blue smoke coming out of your stack, not billowing white smoke. You want smoke to be an element of the flavor profile, just like chili powder or salt or any seasoning.
And what does the 3-2-1 refer to?
Three is 3 hours in smoke, 2 hours wrapped, protected from the smoke where the meat can kind of tenderize, and then 1 hour out of the wrap to crisp up the bark.
Huh. Now, you're talking about a smoker, so I'm guessing that a lot of folks that
think about, throwing the odd steak or chicken on the backyard grill, don't have a smoker. Is it an easy thing to get? What do you recommend?
You know, we're big fans of live fire, so we like charcoal and wood or wood chunk, and we try to stay away from gas when we're talking about barbecue. For a quick, easy one is a Weber Smoky Mountain.
Yeah, the Weber's a great choice. If you have a kettle grill, one of the great ways to use a kettle grill is to build a two-zone fire, turn all the vents down a lot, and just let it kind of smolder and burn very lightly on one side. Put the meat on the other side and crack a beer and clear your afternoon. And that's a big part of what this cooking process is. There's easier ways than spending 8 hours cooking a rack of ribs some afternoon to make a meal for a Sunday dinner. But that's not the only reason you cook barbecue.
And you've created a nice excuse to just hang out and have a beer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's not necessarily easy. And I don't know if we really want it to be easy. Like, if you want to have the best ribs at your tailgate, yeah, it's going to take a little bit of hard work.
So we're going to go into your kitchen and do something, right?
Yeah, we're going to go in and we're going to talk about brisket.
Beautiful. Let's head in there.
Yeah. Is that cutting board around somewhere?
Yeah.
It already smells amazing in here. And I know it's, what is it, 9:30 in the morning?
Yeah, it's just all day, though. And you end up smelling like this all day, every day. We get our briskets from Aurora Farms. Awesome. Thank you.
Oh, look at that. Gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous piece of meat. You want to, you know, respect this gorgeous piece of meat and not screw it up. We want to maybe light seasoning and an understated smoke and really respect it over about a 14-hour cook for you guys
here?
Yeah,
it's about an hour a pound we're cooking.
Wow.
250 degrees.
So is your smoker going pretty much all the time?
About 24 hours a day. What's going to happen now is we're going to pull out. We open this up. I can show you what's happening here.
Anyone you want me to grab here, Andy?
I think anyone should be good. I mean,
oh my God! The smell coming out of this oven the is so delicious.
What you can see here is it's black, golden, brown. This is the caramelization, a deep, deep, deep caramelization. Salt, some peppers, and the smoke.
So, Chris, what went on there in terms of the rub?
Andy got this beautiful bark, and it's really almost only salt and pepper.
Wow.
That's really one of the hallmarks of one of the things you're looking for, like, centrally as you're cooking a piece of brisket, is the appearance of the bark.
So yeah. You've got this dark bark, as you call it, but it's also the juices are coming out from the inside,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, even on that lean part of the flat, that is somewhat of a lean piece of meat, you can see the juices kind of bubbling up into the into the bark.
It's beautiful.
And it's, I'm going to slice it here. What kind of accumulates as you process a dozen briskets or 20 briskets over a service is the little scraps on the side of the board. And these little burnt ends kind of accumulate. Some Kansas City restaurants just started giving them out as little snacks while people waited in line. And over time, it kind of developed and people said, you know what, that's the best part of the brisket.
I've heard these described as meat candy.
Everything that's great about a brisket or a piece of barbecue is super intensified in these burnt ends.
All right, I'm going to try one, okay?
Yeah, you should.
All right.
It's almost too much, right?
No, but it's delicious.
It's almost too smoky, almost too salty.
Not for me. It's great. But now, you wouldn't recommend this for the home cook, because this is, I mean, this literally took an entire day in a smoker, right?
Not on your first project. Recommend trying to cook a brisket for a big, Sunday dinner when you've never cooked one before and you have, 15 people coming over. Probably not the best time.
Yeah, but we would strongly suggest you try it.
Let me ask you about the sort of tradition of the regional tradition of this kind of cooking, because I think a lot of people would think of this kind of smoking meats as a southern tradition. Does it belong here in New England? By belong, I mean, is there a tradition here in New England to do this?
Texas-style barbecue, North Carolina-style barbecue, Kansas City barbecue. It's as red, white, and blue American as it gets. And one of the things that we kind of thought about was, can new styles of barbecue evolve?
In my opinion, it is the only true American cuisine.
Well, thanks for letting us taste this great American tradition.
Thanks for coming.
So that's Andy Husband, chef and owner of The Smoke Shop in Cambridge and co-author with Chris Hart of Pitmaster Recipes, Techniques, and Barbecue Wisdom. Chris Hart, Andy Husband, thank you both very much.
Thanks for coming.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right like green tomatoes.
And you can see some great pictures of that smoked brisket from our visit this morning and find recipes for Andy and Chris's 321 ribs at radioboston.org. And who knew that smoked burnt ends could be so good for breakfast? That's it for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
With me, most anything goes. I look in the pot, I'm fit to fight. Woman.